It's about time to begin tonight. Les, could you do the opening prayer?
Yes. Lord, we're so grateful for the blessings of life, for this beautiful day, for the sunshine and the rain that we've been receiving, for the beauty of your creation that comes alive in this season of spring. We give you praise and honor and glory for all the goodness that you've shown us, each one of us. Pray that you would be with Andrew and the other teachers in this hour, and that the students here are open to the things that he has to say, and that we may learn more of your will and learn more of who you are and what your nature is, so that we can follow you and follow your son Jesus. In his name we pray. Amen.
Amen. All right, everyone can turn to Nahum chapter 1. We will be staying in the book of Nahum almost exclusively tonight. I'm just going to work my way from the front and work back. But if I could have, let's see, let's start on this side. Daryl, could I get you to read Nahum 1:1?
Nahum 1:1, the oracle of Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum, the Elkoshite.
All right. So right off the start, he says the burden against Nineveh. My translation says it could either be translated as oracle or prophecy. So we're not even waiting around. We're jumping right into exactly what this book is about. And what is that? If you could sum it up in one word, what would that be?
The fall of Assyria.
Fall of Assyria. That's not...
Destruction?
Destruction would be a good word.
Judgment.
There's the word I was looking for. Judgment against Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrians. So this book could have some alternate titles. The message Jonah wanted to preach. Because he went there. So the entire book of Jonah, the prophecy that he gives is like one sentence. Does anyone remember exactly what it was? 3 chapters, 1 sentence. Everything else is about Jonah. So, but another word could be God's final judgment, or simply the fall of Assyria. All right. So, there we go. All right. We're going to do things a little differently tonight than we do most of these books. And my print is a lot smaller than it looked like on my computer screen. Since we are detailing an historical event, or the prophecy of a historical event, we're going to have a lot more history tonight than we do in a lot of the smaller minor prophets. All right, first off, Nineveh, ancient city founded by Nimrod in Genesis chapter 10. Frank, could you read me Genesis 10, 8 through 12? Chapter 10.
Genesis. Yeah. I'll get there.
All right. So given how far... 10, 8 through 12...
The sons of Ham were Cash, it looks like Miriam.
Verse 8.
I can't see how to read this.
Okay. All right. I'll read it real quick. Genesis 10, verse 8, Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Kana, and the land of Shinar. From that land, he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, and Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. So, very ancient city. It's if it was still around today, it pushed Damascus for the oldest city in the world. Damascus is pushing right about 4,000 years right about these days. So we see even early in Genesis, it's one of your early regional powers. It falls in and out of that through time. About 2000 BC, they were able to break off one of the other local empires that had been controlling it and were able to get independent. The fall of the Hittite Empire in the 13th century led to a power vacuum that helped Assyria grow beyond its tiny little region in Upper Mesopotamia, and they even conquered Babylon in the early 13th century. They lost their power, but then was able to regain it again starting in about the 10th century BC. Historians like to call these two empires differently. So starting in the 10th century, you have what is called the Neo-Assyrian Empire, which is what we have going into this book. All right. The newly empowered Assyrian Empire would first meet the Israelites in the Battle of Karkar in 853 BC. The glyph right here actually details the account. One of the few times that Ahab and Ben-Hadad, king of Assyria, actually get along. Ben-Hadad apparently led a coalition of 12 kings with the help of King Ahab of Israel, who, according to the text behind me, donated 2,000 chariots and a number of horsemen to the battle. They were able to fight the Assyrians to a standstill at this time. Tiglath-Pileser III is the first king of Assyria, excluding Nimrod, just for anyone getting technical on me. First king of Assyria named in the Bible. He conquered Syria, Babylon, most of Israel, and placed both Israel and Judah under tribute. And we can find that in 2 Kings 15:29. Lori, could I get you to grab that real quick? Rick, could I get you to read... I did not put the verses up. We'll start with Lori.
In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and captured Ijon, Bibel-Beth-Makkah, Genoa, Kadesh, Hazor, Gilead, and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried the people captive to Assyria.
All right. If you could read for me, check 2 Chronicles 28, starting in verse 16 to 20. Yes.
At that time, King Ahaz sent to the kings of Assyria for help. For again, the Edomites had come and attacked Judah and carried away captives. The Philistines also had invaded the cities of the lowland and of the Negev of Judah, and had taken Beth-Shemesh, Ahiron, Gederoth, and Soko with his villages, Timnah with its villages, and Gimzo with its villages, and they settled there. For the Lord humbled Judah because of Ahaz, king of Israel, for he had brought about a lack of restraint in Judah and was very unfaithful to the Lord. Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came against him and afflicted him instead of strengthening him. Just 20.
All right, so... Assyrian. Assyrian Empire. King Ahaz is like, help me, help me. They come in. What'd they do? Make the situation worse. They help beat out the Syrians that were beating them. And then they go and are far worse than what the Syrians ever were by enacting far more tribute. Okay. Jonah probably arrived in Nineveh somewhere around
790 to 750 BC because of
in Kings, it actually details what King Jonah actually lived in. He lived there in the reign of Jeroboam II.
So that was about the point in time that he lived. This period actually saw a weakening of Assyrian power for several decades. In fact, the Assyrian records actually kind of go blank during this period. So they kind of go quiet, and you don't even hear anything about them. Then about 745, Tiglath-Pileser comes to the throne, and suddenly he goes on a major conquest.
Zenopath, a Greek scholar in the 4th century BC, said the ruins of the walls of Nineveh were 25 foot wide and 100 feet high, and a circumference of 7 miles. That gives you an idea of just how large this city was. According to Nelson's Bible Dictionary, in Sennacherib's time, the wall of Syria was 40 to 50 foot high, extended for 4 kilometers along the Tigris River and 13 kilometers around the inner city. The city wall had 15 main gates, 5 of which had been excavated. Each of the gates were guarded by stone bull statues. He also built a water system containing the oldest aqueduct in history.
There's a point to all this. We'll get there. As you read through Nahum, we're going to mention gates, walls, and basically none of this is going to matter.
Okay. When you read about the fall of Rome, the fall of Rome doesn't take place in a day. It actually takes place over the better part of a century. They start having inflation, you have invaders, you have plagues, you have more invaders, you have people trying to buy the office of the empire. It's just a mess for about a century or more as it's going slowly downhill. That doesn't happen here. Assyria falls in a matter of a couple years. A coalition of newly independent state of Babylon and allies from Media marched on the Assyrian capital in 612 BC after having battlefield successes in 615 and 614. In 614, the Medes actually burned the city of Asher. Siege of Nineveh only lasted 3 months. You saw the walls, how big those are? That should take a whole lot more than 3 months. With the fall of Nineveh, the capital of Assyria was moved to Haran, and the final battle of the Assyrian Empire came with the defeat of the Egyptian-Assyrian alliance at the Battle of Carchemish in 605 BC. All right, comparison. Nahum, like Obadiah, prophesies the fall of a nation, largely without a historical narrative. There's not any history being written with it because it's written prior to the downfall. Contrast with Jonah. We read Jonah, it's mostly about the telling us what's happening to Jonah, with Nineveh having, the people of Nineveh actually having very little in the actual sentence structure of the book. It's also different from Jeremiah, where the prophecies were largely to prevent imminent danger, the incoming Babylonian destruction. And there's a large amount of historical narrative in the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah going to the kings and pleading them to turn around. Jeremiah talking with the Babylonian guards after the fall. Him discussing the fall of Jerusalem. You don't have that here. It's somewhat difficult to trace the year when the book is written. Scholars differ on dates. Based on more reliable scholars, a.k.a. not humanistic, that want to say that everything in the Bible was written after everything happened, it was probably written somewhere between 715 and 650 B.C. The most ancient scholars I found put him in 720 during the reign of Jotham, son of Uzziah. Modern scholars of the more reliable type tend to place it actually in the 650s because the only historical thing that Nahum alludes to in the book is the fall of Thebes, which occurred in 663 BC. Now remember, the fall of Nineveh happens in 612, so we're still a good solid 50 years prior, even at the later date. He's called an Elkoshite in verse 1, but we actually don't know where that is. So you have people coming up with all sorts of explanations of where, when, and that location is. So it's either like a small village that doesn't get mentioned very often, or some scholars say he may have been in the Israelite captivity earlier and was living in some place abroad. Doesn't really say. We're not told. All right. Oh, yeah, we'll get there in a minute. All right, so back to Nahum. All right, Ray, could I get you to read chapter 1, starting in verse 2, and go through let's stop you at the end of verse 3, and then I'll get you to read through verse 8.
The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord is avenging and wrathful. The Lord takes vengeance on his adversaries and keeps wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power, and the Lord will by no means clear the guilty. His way is in whirlwind and storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. Did you say stop there?
Yes, stop there real quick. Did you have something?
Sorry. I don't mess with you. I was reading a little bit of Elkoshite.
Okay, all right.
So he's an Elkoshite. It says, Elkosh was a city in Assyria, a few miles north of the ruins of Nineveh. Nahum could well have lived there and prophesied to Nineveh, as Daniel did to Babylon later on.
That definitely was one of the things that I had seen. There's actually a Muslim tomb to Nahum. They also have one for Jonah, too, except it got ransacked about 10 years ago by ISIS. I had seen that. Don't know how accurate that is, but it's definitely a possibility. Now, if you see tidbits like that, let me know.
You're doing great. All
right, so. All right, starting verse 2, God's jealous and avenges. And what does it say right here he's taking vengeance on? His enemies. So, straight back to verse 1, who are his enemies in this book? Yeah, Nineveh. This book does not sugarcoat anything. We start off at...
It's interesting though, when you read Isaiah, he calls Assyrian his servant, I believe.
He does, and in this book he says they're toast. All right, so at the end of verse 3, though, Lord has his way with what? Whirlwind and storm. What does that remind you of? Invasion? Is there another place in the...
Elijah is what I thought. Yeah.
Okay, we got Elijah. With a whirlwind? Job. There we go. Could you read that for me? I think it's Job 38, verse 1, I think.
And the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said... That's the end of verse 1.
You can read verse 2 if you...
Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?
All right. Has his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are as the dust of his feet. All right, you can continue to verse 8.
He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. He dries up all the rivers. Bashan and Carmel wither. The blooms of Lebanon withers. The mountains quake before him. The hills melt. The earth heaves before him, the world and all who dwell in it. Who can stand before his indignation? Who can endure the heat of his anger? His wrath is poured out like fire, and the rocks are broken into pieces by him. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in him. With an overflowing flood, he will make a complete end of the adversaries and will pursue his enemies into darkness.
All right, so we have a couple of things. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. Where have we seen that?
Crossing the Red Sea.
Crossing the Red Sea. All right. He then mentions rivers. Mountains quake before him and the hills melt. So he's demonstrating God's power, his might. And what is the image here probably trying to get across? Nothing's going to stand in his way.
He was hiding in that cave. I mean, you know, it said the rocks broke too, you know. Mm-hmm.
So in verse 6, it changes from descriptions of the mountains quaking and all these natural things that happen. We switch to what? Talking about his fierceness, his indignation, his anger, his fury. But then it makes a change in verse 7. So someone want to explain to me the contrast between the two? So what have we have already seen with Nineveh? Because Jonah's been here about 100 years prior. So what happened then? And what happened?
They were spared.
They were spared. He protected them from the trouble that was coming upon them.
I mean, your perspective of God is based on whether you're his adversary or you're one of his people.
There we go. And at one time, for a very brief period in history, Nineveh listened. Okay. Next sentence, read verse 8 again.
With an overflowing flood, he will make a complete end of the adversaries and will pursue his enemies into darkness.
Jesus.
Yeah, I was just going to point out back in verse 2, all this judgment and the terrifying approach of God, if you want to put it that way. This isn't God is slow to anger. But all this description, it's like he makes the point God is slow to anger. And his mercy on Nineveh with Jonah's situation is an example of that.
And that was a good century prior. But with an overwhelming flood, he'll make it utter into this place, and darkness will pursue his enemies. Anybody want to take a stab at that second bit?
Noah.
Okay. All right. This is an interesting verse in the book, because it may not completely be figurative flowery language. There are histories written that say that the Tigris River overflowed its banks and wiped out part of the wall of Nineveh, allowing its enemies to enter. So the flood actually might be quite literal in translation. And from that point on, they just ran what little army that could make it out, that survived the pillage and plunder of the city, got out and ran. And they were just constantly chased after by the Babylonians and the Medes until Carchemish. All right. So let me see here. Let's see who's next. Ken, could you read 9 through 11 for me, please.
What do you plot against the Lord? He will make a complete end. Trouble will not rise up a second time, for they are like entangling thorns, like drunkards as they drink. They are consumed like stubble, fully dry. From you came one who plotted evil against the Lord, a worthless counselor.
Okay, so conspire against the Lord. Where have we seen this happen? Okay, I was thinking of Nineveh, though, as in specific, or at least its rulers. Okay, what happened? They were defeated, but what happened first?
The letters that were sent to Hezekiah.
Letters that were sent to Hezekiah, and what did they say?
You know, like they're mocking, the gods in these other nations. Your God's the same way, you know, no one can stand against us. We're going to come tear you down anyway. And your God's not going to be able to protect you.
What happened?
Hezekiah lays them out and says, look what they're saying. And then 185,000 were killed overnight by the angel.
Interesting thing about the invasion of Judah is actually written in the Assyrian chronology. They tend to leave that part out. The Egyptians actually wrote about it, as did the Israelites, because it's written for us in Kings. The Egyptians have an altered version that still describes the army getting wiped out by what they describe as a plague. But the Assyrians, when they went back home, they wrote, yeah, we went down there, we destroyed Lachish, and Hezekiah paid up and we left. Like, you left part of that out. But
David numbered the people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and he was condemned for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
He sent an angel that cost 40,000, if I remember correctly. I can correct my memory wrong.
Over 3 days.
And so you think of a plague spreading really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Lord has... Could it have been that an angel directly came down and slew them directly, or whether an angel was the sender of a plague, like we kind of see in the account there with David, that caused the plague? Possibly.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly. That it is an immediate plague that caused that, but how did he slew? We don't know. It just said he slew.
Interesting thing in the Egyptian thing, they still divine it to the divine intervention, just not correctly.
Yeah.
But they're still like, they walked into the camp, all these people are dead. They said that mice had come and ate the bowstrings of their bows, so they were useless. So they're like, well. And they ran back home. But I think it's probably what he's talking about, conspiring against the Lord here. But he also says he's making an end of it. Affliction will not rise up a second time. So this is the last time Assyria is going to show up here. If you take the later writing to Nahum somewhere around 650... It's possible this was written sometime in the reign of Manasseh, possibly after he had got dragged to Babylon and came back. So they've came and they're not coming again. That could be a reference to that incident. All right, so how does he describe Nineveh or the Assyrians here in the next verse? Verse 10. Tangled like thorns and drunk like drunkards. How would you like a bunch of drunks running an army, fighting for you? How's that going to go? Not so good. So 11 also says, when from you comes forth one who plots evil against the Lord and wicked counselor. All right, Jesse, could I get you to read 12? Just get you to read the rest of the chapter.
Okay. Thus says the Lord, though they are safe, and likewise many, yet in this manner they will be cut down. When he passes through, though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no more. For now I will break off his yoke from you, and burst your bonds apart. The Lord has given a command concerning you. Your name shall be perpetrated no longer. Out of the house of your gods I will cut off the carved image and molded image. I will dig your grave, for you are a vile people. Behold, on the mountains the feet of him who brings good tidings, who proclaims peace. O Judah, keep your appointed feasts. Perform your vows, for the wicked one no more shall pass through you. He is utterly cut off.
All right, again, we have the back and forth between the people of God and the people of Nineveh, between destruction and salvation. So we see him mentioning, though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no more, and I have broken his yoke from you. Contrast with the next verse is, your name shall be perpetuated no more. I will destroy the house of your gods. I will cut off the carved images and the molded images, and I will dig your grave. So, they're going down, and you ain't seeing them again. And Assyria never was a world power again. Nineveh, it's modern-day Mosul, Iraq. We know it just because of some fighting that occurs every once in a while that we hear about. And it's the tomb, it's the alleged tomb of Jonah. Other than that, it's really not that significant in world, to the world anymore.
I guess the I will dig your grave thing is like, that's the period at the end of Assyria's history.
Mm-hmm.
My footnote says that it's Nineveh was so completely wiped out that its ruins were not identified by archaeologists until 1845.
This is true, but we're going to talk a little bit more about that here in just a few minutes. Because it ain't just the fact that the ruins weren't discovered till recently. But we're going to see here in just a few minutes that even the ancients didn't know what they were within 2 centuries of each of this happening. All right, we're going to have to speed things up here. Let's talk about Nahum. Skip ahead just a second here to Nahum 3. If we got time, we'll come back, slide back. We're let's start in verse 8 and read through 11. Dad, could I get you to read that? Chapter 3, 8 through 11.
Are you better than Thebes, situated on the Nile, and water around her? The river was her defense, the waters her wall. Cush and Egypt were her boundless strength. Put and Libya were among her allies. Yet she was taken captive and went into exile. Ransoms were dashed to pieces at every street corner. Lots were cast for her nobles, and all her great men were put in chains. You too will become drunk. You will go into hiding and seek refuge from the enemy.
The picture behind me is Thebes, what's left of it. It's actually still got some pretty incredible architecture and stuff still in the ruins of the city, but its natural waterways, which provided its defense, were of no help. Assyria conquered and, well, did this to the city in 663 BC. So in these verses, he's making a comparison that Nineveh is going to be like Thebes. Becca, could I get you to go back to chapter 2 and read verses 3 through 10?
The shield of his mighty men is made red. The valiant men are in scarlet. The chariots shall be with flaming torches in the day of his preparation, and the fir trees shall be terribly shaken. The chariots shall rage in the streets. They shall jostle one another in the broadways. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like lightning. He shall recount his worthies. They shall stumble in their walk. They shall make haste to the wall thereof, and the defense shall be prepared. The gates of the river shall be opened. and the palace shall be dissolved. And Huzzah shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up, and her maid shall lead her as with the voices of doves, tabering upon their breasts. But Nineveh is of old, like a pool of water, yet they shall flee away. Stand, stand, shall they cry, but none shall look back. Take ye the spoil of silver, take the spoil of gold, for there is none end of the store, and glory out of all the pleasant furniture. She is empty and void and waste, and the heart melteth, and the knees smite together, and much pain is in all the loins, and the faces of them all gather blackness.
Read 11 real quick, too.
Where is the dwelling of the lions, and the feeding place of the young lions, where the lion, even the old lion, walked, and the lions whelp, and none made them afraid?
All right, so from what I've read, the shields of mighty men are made of red. From what I've read, that may be a description of the Median army. That was the colors that they wore. It mentions the chariots rage in the streets. The streets of Nineveh are wide enough for chariots to go through. This could very well be when the wall has crumbled already and the invading army is pouring in. Mentions nobles stumbling in their walk and making haste to their walls and the fences prepared. Once again, we see another allusion that the gates of the river are opened and the palace is dissolved. So once again, it's possible that the Tigris River flooded and took out a portion of the wall here. There's certainly at least two references in Nahum that seem to back up an account like that. Nineveh of old was like a pool of water. So how would you describe a pool of water?
Stationary.
Not quite the word I'm looking for, but yes, stationary, still, calm, peaceful, safe. No more. Now they're fleeing. Halt, halt, they cry, and no one turns back. So this looks like the defenders trying to gather people to a point. Everyone's just taking off for the hills. Spoil, silver, gold, there's no end of the treasure. The Medes and the Babylonians ransacked Nineveh of everything of worth in the place. Very little that they did not take away. I don't know that we've actually found any precious trinkets that we found from the site. Certainly some writings and descriptions, nothing that would interest your common soldier. But it looks like everything else got carted away. Diodorus the Sicilian in the first century, in his Bibliotheca Historica, which means historical library, he went on the process of writing what he said was the history of the world. Supposedly a set of 40 books, but whether they were destroyed in the Library of Alexandria or not, we only have 15 of them, says that the river flooded and took out a section of the defending wall. Problem with him is that he conflates things, names of people, and Nineveh's on the Tigris River and not on the Euphrates River, which he seems to have mixed up, although a lot of geography students mix that up as well. Xenopath, 4th century Greek historian, was riding through the region with an army 2 centuries later. He's the one I gave the description of the walls of Nineveh a few minutes ago. He doesn't even know what the ruins are for. He thought it was a city of the Medes, which it was temporarily, but that's the only importance he gives to the place. He doesn't realize it was the master of that region of the world up until just 200 years previously. So the only thing he says about it is like, hey, this looks like a good defensible spot. Hey, the Medes used it. It's an old city of the Medes. Nope, not a bit. They might have camped there for a bit, but they may even inhabit it for a bit, but it was definitely not a city of the Medes. It was the powerhouse of the Assyrian Empire.
But even 200 years after the fact, that had been forgotten. What little some of your Greek scholars later on wrote about it basically said that when Nineveh fell, that was the end of the city. There was no more. Let's see, what else can we get through? Okay, we got about 4 minutes left. Zach, could I get you to read chapter 3, 14 through the end of the chapter?
Draw water for the siege, strengthen your forts, go into the clay, tread the mortar, take hold of the brick mold. There will the fire devour you. The sword will cut you off. It will devour you like the locusts. Multiply yourselves like the locust. Multiply like the grasshopper. You increased your merchants more than the stars of the heavens. The locust spreads its wings and flies away. Your princes are like grasshoppers, your scribes like clouds of locusts, settling on the fences in a day of cold. When the sun rises, they fly away. No one knows where they are. Your shepherds are asleep, O king of Assyria. Your nobles slumber. Your people are scattered on the mountains, with none to gather them. There is no easing your hurt. Your wound is grievous. All who hear the news about you clap their hands over you. For upon whom has not come your unceasing evil?
Okay. So draw your food and water for a siege. Siege only lasted 3 months, so for a siege at the time, that's a very short amount of time. Samaria was surrounded for like 9 years in comparison. There the fire will devour you and the sword will cut you down. Once the different histories say different things, some say that when the floods took out part of the wall, a group of the nobles opened the gates of Nineveh to their enemies. Despite that, their enemies had no interest at all of peace. So they went in on a rampage and destroyed the city. That could be, and they definitely set fire to the gates. All those 15 gates we mentioned, they burned them.
Verse 13, it says, look at your troops, they're all weaklings. If I remember, the Rabshakeh told Judah, remember, if you can muster men to even ride horses, he was taunting them, making fun of them, what's coming back on them. And also, when you were reading chapter 2, it talks about lions. You know, Assyria is, there's a lot of references to Assyria and lions.
That was their symbol. It was the preferred symbol of the king of Assyria was lions. He actually went and hunted. The king of Assyria went and hunted lions as part of his kingly duties, as a symbol of his power. But unlike Rome, when it mentions, at the end of Revelation, when it mentions that the great city is fallen, it mentions the merchants of the world line up and weep for her. Is that happening here? Final verse, what's happening when everyone hears about the fall of... Everyone's celebrating. This is a party. So, that is the fall of Nineveh. I had to draw that sentence out just to make sure we hit the bell. All right.